grieving. Some families will be lost to one another forever. To those of you who face the difficulties of reconnecting with family and establishing ongoing relationships, we say sorry. We offer this apology in the hope that it will assist your healing and in order to shine a light on a dark period of our nation's history. To those who have fought for the truth to be heard, we hear you now.
You're listening to Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. I'm one of your hosts, Jo Sparrow. This podcast is a production of Jigsaw Queensland Post-Adoption Support Service. However, the views expressed are those of the people participating, not necessarily Jigsaw Queensland. The podcast discusses adult themes and listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome to Adopt Perspective. I'm your host, Jo Sparrow. Today's guest was born in England in 1970 and was adopted at 6 weeks of age into a family who already had an adopted son. Lisa Preston's family moved to Australia when she was 2 years old, and the family grew to include a biological daughter. Lisa's story of reunion spans two decades, two continents, and is a testament to courage, tenacity, and understanding that a no doesn't always stay a no. Welcome to Adopt Perspective, Lisa. I'm so happy to have you join us.
Hi, Jo. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to tell my story. It's, it's actually a really important part of a healing journey, and I never thought that I would get to this point to tell my story.
And that is, it's something I hadn't thought about when we started the podcast about how much sometimes just telling the story is part of that healing journey for people as well as people hearing it. So thank you for being courageous enough to step up and share with us.
Yeah, it does take a lot of courage. It certainly does.
Can I just start by asking you to share a little with us about what it was like for you to grow up adopted?
Well, it was tough. It was really, really tough and just not easy. And as we know, with adoption, we all start with a loss and, you know, the loss of our birth mother. And so that's a trauma that we live with the rest of our lives. And then my adoptive mother just wasn't a good fit for me at all. And that was really sad. And it's actually quite difficult to talk about. So my parents had adopted my brother first, and then they adopted me, and then we left the UK and moved to Australia when I was two, and my parents went on to have their biological daughter. And so once their biological daughter came along, if my mum could have given my brother and I back, she would have. And she was unable to cope with her feelings. And I don't know in the time back, you know, when I was growing up, how much support there was for parents who had adopted children. But she was unable to regulate her feelings, and she was emotionally and physically very abusive. And that was really hard to cope with. And because of that, I've become a very good people reader. I used to be able to come home from school and I could tell what mood she was in by the way she had her hair, the clothes that she had on. And she was a very scary and frightening person to have as a mother. And she is in her 80s now, and she's, you know, very much on the outer circle of my life. And I have cut her out of my life a couple of times for a year at a time. But in order for me to be able to see my extended family, it's easier if I keep her on my outer circle so that my extended family doesn't have to choose. And it makes, you know, it's really important for me to have that connection with my family. So when I actually saw her the other day, when I'm going to see her, I feel very anxious. I can feel sick to the stomach, and I make sure my time is short and sweet wherever I'm going. So I actually miss out on a lot of things knowing that she's going to be there, because I can't take too much of her being around.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has been very difficult. But the good thing about my adoption was I had a really beautiful dad, and our dad, he died 4 years ago, and he was the one that provided the mothering, the calm, the routine and the stability. And I'm very fortunate that even though my sister, you know, was treated very differently. We have a good relationship, and I have a good relationship with my brother as well. So yeah, that there are good things that can come out of it.
Yeah,
and I know that maybe, you know, not even people that it's their biological mother. You know, people can not get on, and it can not go well for them as well. So yeah, we just were not a good fit.
Yeah. What was it like growing up with an adopted brother in the house? Like, I didn't have anyone else who was adopted in my immediate family.
Nothing up until, recently. It was nothing. It wasn't anything that we ever talked about. It just is. It just was. It was not really ever much of a discussion.
Yeah.
Having somebody else, and he still doesn't talk a lot about it either.
Yeah. So what led you to first search for your biological parents?
I'd always wanted to find them. I think probably for most adoptees, growing up in a family, for me, I felt like you're always the water boy. You're never quite part of the team. And so I had always wanted to search for my birth mother. I didn't look like anybody in my family. I don't have any traits like anybody in my family. And I had tried to search myself, and I couldn't find any information. And so I just let that slide. And then when I was pregnant with my first son, who's now 23, when you're pregnant, you get asked so many medical questions, and I have no medical history at all. So that really gave me a spurt on to try even harder to find my birth mother. And so the State Library in Sydney holds the births, deaths and marriages. Well, they did some years ago. And I went to the library and I looked up on the microfiche, and I knew roughly how old my birth mother was when I was born. And I knew her name, and I knew, and I tried to work out roughly how old women were back then when they got married, just so I had a starting point to start in a year and then start in the quarters of the years to work out, how I could find her. And it was a bit like going to find a needle in a haystack, but I ended up in a very short space of time finding her marriage certificate. So I thought I was onto a winner there, and I had to assume that she was still married. So I continued to do research myself, and I just kept hitting brick walls. So then I ended up engaging a detective who is a specialist in helping to reunite people, and she's also a social worker, and she is in the UK, where I was born as well. So she has been a really magnificent help.
Yeah, that is just that extra layer of complication, isn't it, when you're searching for a relative that's in another country. You don't have access to the physical records that you can go and look at and do all of that hunting yourself. So it is excellent if you can find somebody who can help you at that.
She was absolutely amazing. I said to her, "What can you do that I can't do?" And she said, "I buy medical information, credit card information." She said, "Wherever your mother is in the world, whether she's alive or dead, I will find her." And she did. She found her within 5 days, and it absolutely blew me away.
You just shared that when your son was born, you were thinking about, medical history and that kind of thing. When I, like our sons are the same age, our first sons, when I first had my son, it really triggered off a lot of things for me. I didn't even know what was going on, but I guess a lot of trauma sort of happened again. His crying would set me off, all sorts of things. How did his birth impact you? Did you find that it impacted you and brought your adoption up to the fore at all?
Oh, absolutely. Sorry, it's going to make me teary to speak about it. I was so excited to be having my first baby, and all I ever wanted to be was to be a mum. And Harry was, my first flesh and blood. And I remember Harry's dad, who's now my ex-husband, he had a friend, and this man's wife had just had a baby. And I remember that man saying to me, "Be prepared for the emotional roller coaster you're about to go on." And I thought, "God, what's he talking about? I'm so excited to have this baby." And sure enough, as soon as Harry was born, it just triggered such an emotional roller coaster. It was a really tough time. I ended up staying in hospital for 10 days. because the emotional wheels just completely fell off. And it really brought home to me very hard that I had no relationship with my adoptive mum, that I just couldn't understand. Here I had this really beautiful baby and I couldn't understand how my mother had given a baby away. And at night, because I had a pretty tricky birth, at night the nurses would come in to take Harry into the nursery and I wouldn't let them take him. He had to stay right next to me, even though I was in a lot of pain. I just said to them, he's not going anywhere. I couldn't let him out of my sight.
Yeah.
So it was a really tricky time. And I ended up with very bad postnatal depression. It was a really tough time to try and get myself out of that. And even then I didn't get any help. I didn't seek enough help. I just tried to pull myself out of it and keep going, as you do. And that probably wasn't the right thing to do. And when I had my second son, Hugo, who's now 20, I knew that I was having a cesarean. And, you know, when you have a cesarean, the operating theatre is air conditioned. So they take the baby away out of that cold environment. And I didn't want that to happen. And I knew that I would find that very upsetting. So I paid for a midwife to come and be with me. And when Hugo was born, they wrapped him up in a space blanket and put a beanie on him and so I could hold him. Yeah. So that was really, really lovely and very important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they were there, yeah. And it's affected my whole, how I parented them, which is probably hard for them. And I haven't let them, I haven't wanted to let them out of my sight.
Yeah.
And I found it very hard to even just go out to dinner or do something like that without them. But, gradually over time I did that. And now I'm an empty nester. And that was really hard for most people. They do find becoming an empty nester hard. But I think being adopted, it's extra hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to let them go. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that and for going there. I know it's really difficult, even from my own experiences. I know that that's probably the touchiest area of my life. And just for the listeners, we did do an episode in a previous season with Dr. Jenny Conrick, who's done a little bit of research into mothers and adoptees as mothers. And I know she's working on getting some more research going with that. And I really think it's very, very necessary to examine that. So thanks.
Oh, it is. I think people need to become more educated about it, because I think the nurses and the doctors were a bit alarmed at my response, but it just triggered so many things and brought up so much sadness.
Yeah.
In amongst a really happy time.
Yeah.
Mm.
So let's go back to your search. You've got your private investigator on the job in the UK. What happens?
So she was such a wonderful woman and a very experienced person. And when she had located my birth mother, she found her living in Scotland. And she knew all about my birth mother, even down to what car she drove, what day she went shopping, where she lived, how many kids she had, where they went to school. So this poor woman didn't even know that she had been found. And so the detective said to me, "Are you ready for me to make contact with her?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, "What are you going to do?" And she said, "I'm going to send her a letter." And the letter says, "I'm researching a family tree on behalf of a client. My client believes they're related to you, and this person was born in blah, blah, blah." So for the birth mother, the penny would drop, but for her husband, it wouldn't blow her cover. So she sent the letter, and it took 10 days for my birth mother to respond. And she rang the detective, and my birth mother was really angry and very scared that she'd been found. And the first question she asked was, "Does Lisa have my contact details? Does she know where I live?" And the detective said, "Yes, she does, but she's chosen a responsible form of contact. And she lives in Australia, and she's not about to turn up on your doorstep." So the poor detective had to tell me, "Actually, your birth mother doesn't want to meet you." And that was very sad and really hard to get over. And I'm a secret. So my birth mother is still married to the same man to this day. And she's been married to him for 51 years, and he still doesn't know I exist. Her three adult children don't know I exist. So the detective, because of her wise experience, she said to me, I want you to never, ever give up hope. She said, there's one thing I can guarantee you. She said, people's lives are always changing. And she said, at some point in your birth mother's life, things will change. And she said, everyday things that happen to people get divorced. She said, people get ill. She said, her children will grow up and move out of home, and it'll find her traveling, somewhere and start to give her more freedom. And she said, what I want you to do is every year send her a Christmas card, or if you move house, send her a little card. And she used to run an Airbnb at her farm. And so she said, don't blow her cover, but just send a little chatty, the kids are well, we're having Christmas at the beach, and just so as if you had been a guest at her place, and just giving her a gentle poke to let her know that you're not going away, you're still in the background, and at some point you hope that she can find the courage to deal with you. And so I did that. I wasn't fantastic at doing that, but I did it. Particularly if I moved house, I would let her know where I had gone. But she's never ever responded to me once in 23 years.
Yeah, that's a lot take on, and I can't imagine how that felt to you at the time, and how you sort of resolved that in your mind. Did you just try and push it to the side, or?
Yes, I think so. I think I must be a fairly resilient person. I just had to get on with life, and I think I was in that busy time of having my first baby, and life goes on, and you get distracted by other things, and it's just the way it was, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't make her meet me as much as I wanted to meet her. There's nothing I could do about it,
Yeah.
but it was still hard.
Yeah. So something happened that made you decide to pick this search up again. Can you tell us
It
about that?
certainly did. It certainly did. So my brother, who was adopted, he was adopted from England as well. So my parents that adopted us lived in the UK for 10 years, and they couldn't have children. So they adopted my brother first from a different family. And he came from a fairly aristocratic family, and his mother gave him up and got him back three times. And she was very devastated to give him up. And during COVID, my brother decided, and I don't know why, all of a sudden he decided that he too wanted to find his birth mother, because all the years growing up, he's like, don't even talk to me about it. I'm not interested. I have a family, and that's all I need. So I don't know what triggered him to do it finally. So he engaged the same detective that I used. And they sent the same letter to his birth mother's apartment, and they found her living in Spain. And it ended up being very sad. The letter arrived one day to her apartment, and unbeknownst to the detective, his birth mother, Harriet, was in palliative care, and she died the next day. And my brother was just absolutely so traumatized, and so the pain that he felt. You could feel it. And I just felt so sorry for him. And so Harriet has three sisters, and one of the sisters reached out to my brother via the detective, and the three sisters have really welcomed my brother into their family. And as much as that's lovely, it's just not the same as being able to meet your birth mother. And he was so close.
Yeah.
And when the sisters were cleaning out Harriet's apartment, they did a FaceTime call with my brother and showed him around the apartment and asked him if there was anything that he would like. And that was very kind. They've been very generous in their time with him and making him feel part of their family. And they also got into Harriet's safe, and in her safe there was a letter, and she had written to my brother over the years, and she too had used a detective and found my brother living in Sydney, and she didn't know whether he knew he was adopted, so she got cold feet. and she didn't do anything about it. So they just kept on missing each other. But it was so lovely for him to have that letter about how much she loved him, and, you know, a little bit about the circumstances. And, you know, she had tried, and she didn't ever marry. She had a couple of relationships. She didn't ever go on to have any more children. And every time it was my brother's birthday, she would take herself away for a week and just be by herself. Yeah. So because of my brother's devastation, last year, so it was during COVID, and then, you know, we've all gone back to work and COVID's, you know, behind us now. But at the end of, towards the end of last year, I woke up one day and I said to my husband, I'm going to be like my brother. It's going to be me. If I don't get on a plane and go to England and seek out my birth parents, I'm going to be in that same pain. I'll never have any answers. And I'm going to have to do it, for better or worse. I'm going to have to try. So he said, okay, if that's what you want to do, then we'll do it. So I wrote probably a couple of months before we were leaving. I wrote to my birth mother, and it was a very risky thing to do because I actually don't have a direct email to her. I have a business email, and she's in business with her husband and two of her three children. And I don't know who does the admin work at their farm. And so I sent the email to her farm. So that was her farm email. That was pretty risky. But I was at the stage where I thought, well, I don't care. You know, life's moved on. It's time. And my email, I titled it, "It's Time." And I wrote to her and I said that 2 years ago I had done an ancestry DNA test. And I said, I appear on two extensive family trees with you and your three children and your husband and my said father. And I said, so therefore I'm not such a secret. It's only going to take one of your adult children or your teenage grandchildren child to do a DNA test, and the cat's out of the bag. And I also told her briefly about what happened to my brother. And I said, so it's time. We need to do this. And I said, I'm coming over later in the year, and I'm going to look you up. And I received no response back from her, absolutely nothing. So my husband and I went ahead and we booked tickets to the UK. And 3 weeks before we were due to leave, we left in October, at the end of October last year. 3 weeks before we were due to go, I wrote to her again and I said, the tickets are booked. We'll be there at the end of October. It's imminent. I promise I won't turn up at your home because I know that I'm a secret. But I said, I will be contacting you. So I was basically saying, get ready because I'm coming. And 3 days before we were due to leave Australia, I got an email from her, and she's never contacted me ever. And it didn't even say, "Dear Lisa," it just said, "Do not use this email address." She gave me a mobile number and she said, "Call after 11 a.m. And so this is where my husband has been able to be an amazing support. So he's been my intermediary because he isn't emotionally attached to it like me.
Yeah.
So he was able to call her. He called her at 11 a.m. her time. And over the next couple of days, he tried and he just couldn't get to her. She just wouldn't pick up. It just kept on going to message bank. So we got on a plane on a wing and a prayer, not knowing whether she was saying, "Whatever you do, don't come." We didn't know what she was thinking. So it was a fairly ballsy thing to do.
You got that right.
Yeah. yes, it was. And so we arrived into London and we spent 3 days in London. And then on the Friday morning, we got an Uber to Heathrow to hire a car. And I had been awake since 2:30 in the morning, crying my eyes out because it was becoming real. You know, this was it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what made me think I could get through my story without crying. I was thinking, you know, I'll be fine, you know.
I don't think I'm going to get through your story without crying.
So we went to Heathrow and we hired a car and we started our journey to drive to Scotland. And we decided that 11 a.m. we would pull over at a petrol station and that we would call her. And so I got out of the car at 11 a.m. and walked across a big car park into the petrol station at where my husband was trying to call her. And I got a message on my phone saying, call at 3:30 p.m. So I walked back to the car and I said to my husband, we've got this message. So we got back in the car and it was a 6-hour drive and we drove all the way into her village. She doesn't live in the village. She lives out of the village. And so it was literally a two-horse town. There was just not much there at all. There was a little tiny general store and a really little old pub. So we went to the pub and we had a couple of hours to kill. And we were sitting in the pub and then come 3:30, my husband stood up to go back outside to the car. And just as he stood up, the song that we had at my adoptive dad's funeral started playing at the pub. And I knew then that my dad was helping. Yeah. I knew that he had it in hand. And, you know, it was the song, you know, that Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun. Yeah, it was so lovely. So my husband went out to the car and she picked up straight away. And she tried to duck and weave straight away. She said, we're farmers. We work 7 days a week. I can't come. I don't have the time. And my husband said to her, well, he said, I run five companies. This is the worst time of year for me to be away. I don't need to be in the back end of Scotland somewhere. He said, let's get the job done. And he said, you have the opportunity to meet a really beautiful person. And he said the more that he spoke to her, the more she softened. And she said, if I do it, she said, I need to put some boundaries in place. And my husband said, what are those? And she said, I don't want to talk about the past. It's just too painful. I'll meet you for an hour and it's a once-only contact. That's it. And he said, all right, we can do that. And he asked her where she would like to meet, and she gave us a meeting spot. And that was on the Friday that we spoke to her. And I was in the pub and I could see through the window and I could see my husband in the car. And he's going, yes, yes, give me the thumbs up. We've got a meeting. And I couldn't believe it. It was just so exciting. So she wasn't going to meet us till the Monday afternoon. So you can imagine the stress. So we had to go and entertain ourselves for the weekend. My poor husband, I don't know how he coped with me because I was just a crying, you know, nervous wreck. And so on Monday, we'd been to Edinburgh for the weekend. So we drove out of Scotland over the border and back into England, back to the meeting spot that she had suggested. And so she met us under secrecy, and she it was quite away from her home so that no one would recognize her.
Yeah.
And it was such a brave thing of her to do. And she's an only child. There's no one to tell. And I was so worried that she wasn't going to turn up. And so I asked my husband, I said to him, I wanted to get to the venue where we were going early. And I said to him, I just want to sit in the car park for a bit. So we got there early and we'd been sitting in the car for about 5 minutes. And I said to him, I just can't sit here anymore and I'm dying to go to the loo. So we went into the building and my husband said to me, I'll wait for you here in the foyer. And so I came out of the bathroom and I saw my husband and he was standing there with her, with my birth mother. And it was just so emotional. And she said to my husband, she said, you're right, she is beautiful. And she just cried and cried. And I think all these years that she's pushed it away and pushed me aside, meeting somebody in person is a very different thing.
Yeah.
And so we had about an hour and a half with her, as it turned out. And it was so lovely to sit there and look at her and look in her eyes and hear her voice. It was very, very special. It really was. But she was very guarded in her conversation, I had made a family photo album on my phone of my family, and she didn't want to see. And I think that's it was out of self-preservation.
Yeah.
So all she knows is that I'm married and that I have two sons and I have two stepsons, and that's as much as she wanted to know. She was very guarded in her conversation. She didn't tell me anything about her children. But what she doesn't know is that I follow two of her three children on Instagram because they have business pages, and so they are an open page. And for all these years, it's given me a window into their lives, to see, when there's weddings and christenings and birthdays, and to be able to see, what she looks like. And that's been really amazing. They don't know who I am. They don't follow me, and I never comment on anything that they do. But it's just been technology is amazing, because when I first started my search, obviously there was none of that around.
Yeah.
So it was such a lovely time to spend with her. And she mostly spoke about her farm and how she ended up in Scotland and what she farms. And one of my adoptive mum's sisters is a jeweler, and she made me some really beautiful Australian pearls with some stud earrings. So I had bought a card and written to my birth mother in there and thanked her for being so brave to come and meet me. And I said, these are some Australian pearls put together by my aunt in Australia. And I said, when you wear these, just know that you'll be in my heart and my thoughts. And so when my husband and I walked her to her car, I gave her the card. But she didn't open it there, but she was just sobbing and sobbing. So it was a really special time that we had with her. I was very, very grateful. She did say that her husband, he's 10 years older, and he isn't well at all. So she's nursing him. And I think maybe in the future, she may have the freedom to contact me again. So, and if she doesn't, that's okay. I feel very happy with our meeting, and I really am very grateful that she was brave enough to do it. Yeah. And I also think it was very healing for her and very healing for me.
Yeah. I mean, it
Yeah, it
breaks my
was.
heart that she's not had anyone to talk about this with ever since it
No,
happened. I mean, that just.
she doesn't. And she said she will carry the stigma and the shame of it to her grave. She said it's not something she can ever get over. And that's just so sad. And I'm so glad that we live in a world now where we have all sorts of different relationships, and people generally are not so judgmental. They're just so much more accepting,
Yeah.
of relationships. Yeah. And that's really sad. And she had got really dressed up to come, and I can't imagine, what she told her husband, like where she was going, because she wasn't going grocery shopping. She'd made an effort to look lovely,
Yeah.
and I felt so sad for her that she went home and wasn't able to say, guess what I did today, not being able to tell anybody. How heartbreaking.
Yeah. I do hope that she finds her way to a support group or some peer supports or other people that that she can open up to one day and hear that she's not alone and that she doesn't have to carry that burden around with her for a lifetime.
I hope she does, but I feel she's so in that way, she's so British and so, stoic, and she's coped with it for this long. I don't think she will. I think she'll just carry it to her grave.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is so sad. Such a burden.
Wow. So that is not the end of your journey while you're in the UK. You mentioned earlier that you had done a commercial DNA test and had some idea who your father was.
Yeah, so my father wasn't, I didn't find him through my DNA test. I got my adoption file from the adoption agency in the UK, and when it arrived, in it, it had his name, and it had him as the said father. It wasn't definite. So he had been in a relationship for 5 years with my birth mother, and they had been engaged for 2 years. And when I was conceived, he wasn't quite sure that I was his because there was another guy around at the time. So the relationship fell apart, and he got a bit of an earful from her father and was told to stay away. And also her parents didn't want her to marry a lowly farmer, which was sad. So that all fell apart and he didn't know what happened. So he was the said father. So it had his name and it had his address. So being a bit crazy again, I thought, what are the chances that he still lives at the same place? And sure enough, he did. And so when I contacted him, he was absolutely over the moon to think that he had a daughter. But I contacted him 23 years ago. And he has been married now for 50 years to the same lady. And she brought three children into the marriage, and they didn't ever have any children together. And he isn't much of a chatter on the phone. And so every time I would ring and speak to, I'd have to speak to the wife. I could never speak to him. And she was a little bit standoffish and a bit of the gatekeeper. She didn't particularly want me to be around, and you know, I can understand that. So, you know, it's a bit of a threat, I guess. So a couple of years ago, I did try to do a DNA test with them, and I sent over the ancestry information and the little vial, but they said that they had trouble on the computer end of it and they didn't quite know how to make it work, so we didn't ever do that. So when I knew that I was coming over at the end of last year, I wrote to him and told him roughly when I would be there. And I also included some photographs of myself, and I asked him if he could see any resemblance in of himself in me. And he was communicative with me, and he said no. And I'm thinking, oh dear, maybe, you know, he's not the father. So not 24 hours later, after I met my birth mother, I rang my birth father and I said, I'll be in your area on the Wednesday, and could you meet us for lunch? And he said yes. So we met him in his local pub for lunch. And as soon as I walked into the pub, honestly, I could have laughed and I could have cried all at the same time. As soon as I laid eyes on him, I thought, my God, there is no doubt who the father is, absolutely no doubt. So my birth mother, I look like her, but my birth father, it was like looking in the mirror. And I'm a very big build of a person, and my birth mother is tiny. So she has size 5 feet and I've got size 11 feet and really big hands. And I looked at him and he's a really big man and a really solid build. And I've got a big wide face and so does he. Like, it was so funny to finally see where you come from. So we sat down and had lunch with him and his wife, and the lunch was really hard. The conversation didn't flow. He's not much of a talker. And he sat next to me at the lunch, and every so often I would catch him looking at me, and you could see him thinking, oh my goodness, I've got a daughter. Like, as he could see, there was no doubt that he was the father. And imagine finding out at 76 you have a daughter, and I'm his only child, his only biological child. And so it wasn't till the end of the lunch that my husband was engaging wife in a conversation, and they were looking at his phone at the Ancestry DNA app and talking about what you can learn from it. And my birth father could see that his wife was engaged in another conversation. And he leant over to me and he whispered to me, he said, you know, he said, I can see that you're mine. And it just melted my heart. So at the end of the lunch, we went outside and took a couple of photos and said our goodbyes. And I thought to myself, well, that's it. I've done what I set out to do. I've met both my birth parents, and, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to do that. But, you know, I didn't think there'd be any more contact. And then my husband and I were heading off to stay with his sister in Somerset, but we knew that we weren't going to get there that night. So we drove for a few more hours and stayed in a little village. And then we slept in, and then the next morning we got up and we were having breakfast, and my phone rang. And I said to my husband, "Oh my goodness, it's the wife. She's calling me." And I was so worried that she was ringing to say, "Don't come back, And she said, "My husband and I have been up, till 3 o'clock in the morning. We haven't been able to stop talking about you. Richard's—he's been crying, and he just can't believe it." And she said, "He's so teary, he can hardly speak." And she said, "He wanted me to call you and ask you and your husband if you could come back to our farm and spend the day with us and have lunch with us." And all the years I had Google Earthed his farm and looked around his farm, never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd be driving up his driveway and into his home to have lunch with him. Yeah, it was so special, just lovely. And so we spent the day with him, and they went to so much trouble. And he is 76 and his wife is 86. And she had really changed her tune. She was very welcoming to me and to my husband, which was really lovely. And I think maybe her husband had said, "I've helped you raise your three children, and now it's my turn." So after we had lunch, he took us for a drive around his farm, and then we went for a drive into the village, and he showed us where he went to school, and he showed me where my birth mother grew up, and she had lived in a really beautiful house. And his house and his farm is like something out of a children's storybook. All the fields are all there's hedges everywhere, and he farms sheep. And his home is this lovely storybook house, like it's a sandstone two-story house with roses and fruit trees, and it's just so pretty, and it was so lovely to be there. And then come about 3:30 in the afternoon, I was giving my husband the eye, thinking, telling him we should go. And my birth father kept on saying to me, "Please don't go, please don't go." And so eventually at about 6:30 at night, we left. And he, when we were leaving, he cried and cried and cried. And he just said, "I've had a daughter for a day. You live across the other side of the world. When am I going to see you again?" And it was really sad. And when I met him, he had a little Motorola flip phone, like it was almost kerosene powered phone. And he's never wanted to engage in technology ever. And by the time I made it back to Australia, he'd brought a new phone. And he had a friend down the road show him how to WhatsApp, how to FaceTime, how to send photos. I cannot believe how quickly he has picked it all up. It's just amazing. And so I'm in contact with him every day, and it's really very special. And the connection that we have with each other is. It's really hard to explain. It was an instant love and an instant connection, because I guess because I am of him, and it's just such a special feeling, that unconditional love to have with somebody. And he's not much of a talker, but he just constantly smiles through his eyes. Like it's really lovely, and it's like looking into my own eyes. It's just having that reflected back at you. Is really lovely, very special. And he said to me when I was back in Australia one day, he said to me, he said, "That love that you have for your wife, or you have for your husband." And I said, "Oh yeah." And he said, "With my wife's children," he said, "I could never understand the love that she had for her children." And he said it caused some problems in our marriage over the years. But he said, "Now at 76," he said, "I finally understand, because I've got one of my own." And that's just so beautiful, really lovely. Yeah, so it's just been the most wonderful experience. And then later this year, I will go over and visit him and spend some time with him, because he had three heart attacks last year and he nearly died. So I'm very fortunate that I even got to meet him and that he's welcomed me into his heart. So I definitely will go back and spend some time with him.
Do you think you'll reach out to your mother again when you go over, or?
No, I'll leave the ball in her court. now. She's going through some hard times with her husband, and I think she knows where I am now. We've had the contact and we got on very well. And you know, sometimes you could, I'm sure people meet their birth mother and they may or may not have the same values or the same education or the same outlook on life. You know, we were very much on the same page. So, yeah, I hope that she down the track will contact me when she feels that she can.
Wow, what a story. So you've had a little bit of time, not a lot of time, but a little bit of time to process everything. What have these connections brought to your life?
They've just given me a great sense of peace. And I think in finding your looking for your birth parents, you're ultimately looking for yourself and looking to find that peace. And now I have that, yeah, in you know, bucket loads. So that's been really special. And I just feel a lot of joy. And I have a quiet just confidence and a quiet knowing, yeah, where I've come from. It's just, yeah, made me feel just happy in my skin now, yeah, which is really important. And having like I was just saying before, that unconditional love from my father, that was it's a really lovely thing to experience that. And just, yeah, having you know, like I knew my parents' names, but seeing their faces and seeing them and meeting them has just been wonderful, and it's so important. And I will always feel sad for my brother that he didn't get that opportunity, and he sort of berates himself for not doing it sooner, and he is the reason why I went to do it. Otherwise, I'd still be sitting here hoping and wishing and praying that my birth mother, you know, might decide to finally meet me, but she wouldn't have if I hadn't pushed it.
It's a sad reality, I guess, is that people who've been impacted by this era, time is running out. Like the mothers are an aging cohort. We're even getting older.
Yes, yeah.
And if it is something that you want to make happen, you know, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to seek some support and make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, can I ask you what kinds of things you felt were helpful as you navigated your experience? Like, what kind of supports did you lean on, or what was helpful, I guess?
So, for the last 4 years, I have worked very closely with a psychologist. So, every 2 weeks for the last 4 years, I've worked with a psychologist, and I worked even more closely with her before I left on my trip, because you know, things could have gone wrong, really wrong. And so we talked about you know, if they do go wrong, how are you going to handle it? What are you going to do? So we did a lot of that. And so she's been really, really, really helpful. But I also think I would still like to talk to somebody further who understands the complexities of adoption more. But I am, having worked with a psychologist for 4 years now, feel in a much more peaceful, understanding place, and I'm really glad that I did it. It was very challenging. She made me work really hard. She said, "I'm not here to be your friend." And so, in between, and you know, I'd see her those every 2 weeks, but in between the 2 weeks, I would have homework to do, things to read, things to listen to, things to write. So it was really good. And I've only just recently finished with her, and she was the one. She said to me, "You know," she said, "you don't need me anymore." So that was a really nice place to get to. I have had a fantastic support from my husband. He was just such a great intermediary helping get this all over the line, because just before we were due to go overseas, we have shops, and one of our store managers resigned, and my husband nearly wasn't going to be able to come with me. And I would have found it now, having done it, very hard without that emotional support. My children are an amazing support, so they're really good to lean on. And my extended family have been very supportive. Having the detective, you know, such a wise person, and she's also a social worker as well. So, yeah, she was a great person to have in my corner, actually. So that was good. And also my three Jack Russells. So, you know, they get me out and about every day. So I walk about 10Ks a day, and, you know, that's
Wow.
a walk of mental health, that is. Because, you know, going through my adoption and my life, I've fallen into quite deep depressions at times. And so, yeah, having my animals is really important. So, yeah, that's been great. And also, all I listened to for weeks before I went overseas was lots of adoption podcasts, because it helps to put things into perspective, and it helps to understand, you know, in that whole adoption triangle, other people's angles, where they're coming from and why they might think what they think. And it helped to articulate things for me as well, and to think, yeah, you know, I feel that too. And just listen to the other, to people's stories, has just been so wonderful. So, you know, I hope that, you know, my story will give people hope and not to give up. You know, and if they want to search and meet their birth parents, just keep trying. Don't take no as a no.
Yeah. There's some great advice there. And you know me, I love my dog as well, and get out to walk. And and it is so important that when you think about your mental health and adoption, it's not a one-stop shop. There's lots of things to look after, and your mental health is aided by looking after your physical health and leaning on supports and doing that work before you enter a union. Like, it's good if you've done some actual work on yourself and your understanding of things and your expectations before you rock up and knock on a door, because you just don't know what trajectory is going to happen, and you need to have some ideas in place to help you get through whatever you find.
Absolutely, because I could have been looking at another rejection in the face. Yeah. So we had to talk about, you know, how I might handle that. But I felt it was like, you know, people who have lost someone in their family, you know, there's missing people all over the world. They just want an answer. And I decided that, for better or worse, I needed to put this to bed once and for all. I needed to be able to get on with my life and to stop wishing and hoping. I had to take some action. And I'm so glad that I did, and I'm so very fortunate that it worked out the way that it did.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. There's no one more courageous in my eyes than someone who's been impacted by adoption, who's standing on the edge of that abyss looking in, hoping for a reunion and not knowing what they're going to find. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us today and for reaching out, Lisa. I've so enjoyed hearing it, and I wish you all the very best along with your birth mother and birth father, and I hope those relationships continue to grow and become deeper over time. And I do wish you all the best. So thank you so much.
Oh, I've really enjoyed sharing it with you. Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
And I'm going to be putting some relevant links up on our podcast notes page for listeners as well. So meanwhile, if you have a story that you'd like to share with us and you'd like to be interviewed for the podcast, jump onto our main podcast page of the Jigsaw Queensland website and just complete the prospective guest form that you'll find there. Just note that Adopt Perspective can be and is listened to by people all over the world. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Adopt Perspective podcast. If you'd like to find out more, go to the podcast page on www.jigsawqueensland.com, and you'll find a wealth of information and resources on the website. If you reside in Queensland, you can reach Jigsaw Queensland's Forced Adoption Support Service on toll-free 1800 210313, or you can call Jigsaw on 07 33 58 6666. If you live in another state of Australia, you can still call the Forced Adoption Support Service number, and your call will be answered by the Forced Adoption Support Service in the state that you're calling from. In every other state, Relationships Australia operates this service. A big thank you to Matt Sparrow for composing and recording our original theme music. Until next time, I'm Jo Sparrow, saying farewell from Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. Thank you.